Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Today we're going to take a look at the Battle of Blood River, but today it's going to be a much more visual presentation. A couple of years ago I did do a video about it, but it was a very long-winded thing, and it actually covered a lot of other detail, including what happened in Boer republics afterwards. It actually covered decades worth of events. But today we'll focus just on Blood River and the campaign, and you're going to see a documentary that somebody did that was very good, and it'll give you an idea of what's going on there. Now, if you take a look at this map that's on the screen here, you're going to see something interesting. This is the time when the Whites came to South Africa, and they all came in at the south at the Cape Colony. And then as time went by, more whites came in, and they also had big families, and these whites started pushing inwards further and deeper into Africa. And then what happened was that these whites, who are now known as Boers, these whites lived in the Cape Colony under British rule. The rule changed from time to time because of wars in Europe, but the British came to dominate the Cape Colony. And these Boers did not like the liberalism of the time. So these Boers had been fighting wars against the blacks in the Eastern Cape. And they had fought these wars over a long period of time. But then these whites, these Afrikaans-speaking whites, or Dutch-speaking whites, these whites decided that they were going to go into the interior of Africa to try and find some territory for themselves. They were always riding and exploring deep into Africa on horseback. They would go hundreds of miles into Africa, and they'd meet up with tribes and observe things and come back with news reports. So among these people, they then decided that they were sick and tired of British rule, and they ended up doing something by themselves. In many ways, it's almost like the age of the internet, where people are sick and tired of being told what to do and people are starting to do their own thing. Well, it was like that in the time of the Great Trek. And the Great Trek is what you see on that map there. Those are the various groups of whites with their wagons, with their families, who decided that they're going to go to different parts of Africa to try and settle there. And ultimately, they were looking for territory of their own to live in. This was the beginning of the search of these Boers for actual territory to rule, and later on they did manage to get two countries, two republics of their own. But in the beginning, some of them went off down the east coast of South Africa, and there was a group of them led by a guy called Piet Retief, and they went to speak to the Zulus. And he went to speak to the Zulus about getting territory there on the coast. And this is where the Battle of Blood River comes into it. As these different whites moved around, they also at various points did run into blacks and they did fight battles. But the battle that's remembered the most is Blood River, though it's not the only battle. And even the English also fought big battles against the blacks, the Zulus especially, later on. However, in this case, it was a private enterprise. Whites were doing their own thing. And these whites went and they chatted to the king of the Zulus, and the king said to them that he'll grant them territory to the south of the Zulu kingdom if they go and they capture cattle that had been stolen by another chief. So he set this obstacle or this criteria for these whites to go and do, and these whites decided, yes, they'll go and do it. And they went off and they got the cattle and they brought them back. And then they wanted to sign the deal. So the king of the Zulus ended up actually killing them. And after he killed them, he ordered his armies to go and kill all the other whites who'd gone and settled in those areas. So there were a number of battles after this. After these disasters, another group gathered together, all these Boers gathered together, and they got themselves another leader. And this leader, Pretorius, he is the guy who then took them and they went back up to go and meet the Zulus and fight with the Zulus, and they defeated the Zulus. So this is just a bit of overview. I will comment more on this after you've watched the actual excellent documentary. But that is just the basic gist of it. I'm going to comment on the battle and other things afterwards. Another thing that I want to show people from overseas is that the Battle of Blood River is so important to the Afrikaans-speaking whites of South Africa that it is the only event in the history of South Africa that has a huge monument dedicated totally to it. That photo that you see there is of the monument, that's what they call it in Afrikaans, die monument, and it's built on a hill outside Pretoria. You can see the skyscrapers in the distance, and this thing is big. It's several stories high. You can see on the outside of it, on that wall, that you are looking at images of wagons, because wagons featured very importantly in the battle. This thing is so important to the Boers that every 16th of December they go and they have ceremonies here in this building and also at the actual location of the battle, and they renew their vows to God, because this battle is related to Christianity and to vows that these Boers made to God. So this is the only thing of its kind in South Africa. Nothing the blacks have done is bigger than this, and if the blacks try to mess with this thing, they'll probably have a war on their hands. This is truly the most sacred Christian monument in all of South Africa. And these people take this thing very seriously, and they take their vows to God very seriously. So that's just to give you some background of what you're going to see and its importance in the history of South Africa.
The struggle for freedom and independence is one that is old as mankind itself. It was also the main reason that hundreds of colonists from the British Cape Colony in South Africa decided to leave on an ambitious journey, northwards into the hinterland to establish their own independent state in organized trek parties in 1836 and 1837. Free from the stifling oppression and regulations of British rule. Their epic journey would come to be known as the Great Trek. These Voortrekkers, or Boers as they were called, would in future play a leading role in the history of South Africa, as depicted in frieze at the Voortrekker Monument in Pretoria. The leader of one of the trek parties was Piet Retief, already 56 years old when he was elected as chief commandant and governor of the trekkers. Because of the positive reports that had been received from the inland Natal area, Retief's trek party decided to cross the Drakensberg mountain range to settle there. When Retief and a few of his men made an advance expedition over the Drakensberg and saw the beautiful landscape of Natal, they gazed in awe. The visions and ideals that Retief had of an independent trekker or pioneer republic in Natal are clearly depicted in his statue by Kurt Steinberg in front of the Church of the Vow in Pietermaritzburg. Retief first called on Port Natal, now Durban. About 60 settlers welcomed him very cordially. Two major stumbling blocks had already been overcome. The Drakensberg had been crossed, and the group of British settlers in Natal welcomed his arrival. But there was a third stumbling block, Dingaan, King of the Zulus. He'd murdered his half-brother Shaka in 1829 and moved to a new capital, Ngungunhluvu, place of the elephants. It's about 20 kilometers southwest of the current Ulundi in KwaZulu-Natal province. This capital was later sketched and painted by several people using eyewitness accounts and other sources of the period. Dingaan inherited a well-organized Zulu state and a daunting army from Shaka, and had the support of all Shaka's commanders. The Battle of Blood River would be heavily influenced by the war tactics of the Zulu, refined by Shaka and taken over by Dingaan. Think of the chest, head, and horns of an ox. These were the four tactical units of the Zulu army. Every unit had about 4,000 warriors, a total of 16,000, a similar number to the force that attacked at Blood River. The two horns consisted of the younger and bolder warriors, the feathered feet with the white and brown oxhide shields, armed with up to 4 throwing spears each. They attacked the enemy first, surrounded them, and caused consternation and alarm with their throwing spears that they could hurl as far as 50 meters. In fact, they could hurl up to 32,000 spears at the enemy. The head consisted of the older and more experienced warriors, the ringed heads. They would follow up an attack by the horns and make contact with the enemy with their stabbing spears. They formed up behind the head to support them, and also to prevent the warriors of the head from turning back and fleeing. The fourth unit was the chest, or reserve, and also consisted of experienced warriors. This technique was very effective against rival tribes, but it was not known if it would endure against voortrekkers on horseback, with their muzzle-loading rifles, their flexible battle tactics, and their wagon forts, the so-called loggers. While still in Port Natal, Retief sent a message to Dingaan saying he would be paying him a visit to negotiate for land for the voortrekkers. Retief had no idea that he would be negotiating with a sly, suspicious man, a man who didn't hesitate to murder his own family. Piet Retief looked upon Ngungunhluvu for the first time on the 5th of November, 1837. Today, a few built-up huts can be seen in the background. Retief came from the south and must have approached the capital from slightly to the left of the furthest point in the picture. Dingaan received Retief very cordially, or so it appeared. The negotiations also went without a hitch. Dingaan agreed to grant the area south of the Tukela River to the Mzimvubu River from the Drakensberg to the sea, and including Port Natal, to the voortrekkers. This area was sparsely populated because Shaka had killed off or chased away most of the tribes who lived there.
Kuswa wena, unabo pfakazi na? That's what Ye said.
However, Dingaan's selling price was somewhat strange. Retief had to retrieve oxen from a captain, Sikonyela. The oxen were apparently stolen from Dingaan.
As ons moet ooreenkom oor grond, moet ons eers ooreenkom oor beeste. Jy moet die beeste wat gesteel is terugbring, saam met die diewe. Ek sal van my beestwagte saamsteer. Hulle sal die beeste ken. As jy dit doen, sal ek vir jou grond gee.
Retief was eager to agree to this because his ideal of a free Voortrekker Republic would be a step closer to becoming a reality. First, he had to return to his people whose wagons at this stage were on the plateau named Kirkenberg, on the Natal side of the Drakensberg. News of Retief's successful negotiations with Dingaan had already reached the trekkers earlier, and they started to move towards him. It was Retief's birthday on the 12th of November, and his daughter Deborah painted his name in green paint on a flat stone in the area, where it can still be seen today. The trek down the mountains started on the 14th of November, 1837. News of his successful negotiations with Dingaan had also reached other trek parties, who started moving towards Natal. Among them were the trek parties of Gerrit Maritz, A.H. Potgieter, and Piet Uys. Retief returned to his lager and asked for volunteers to accompany him to Dingaan. The oxen had to be formally handed over. Piet Retief and 69 of his men, among them his son, as well as 30 servants and wagon drivers, left the trekkers on the 25th of January, 1838. They would never return. They approached Dingaan's capital from the west on the 3rd of February, 1838. Dingaan received them the next day, Sunday the 4th. The transport document was explained to Dingaan by Thomas Halstead, an Englishman from Port Natal who could speak Zulu and who acted as an interpreter for Retief. After many questions and explanations, Dingaan signed the treaty. Three trekkers and three chief council members of Dingaan signed as witnesses. Then the festivities began. One can imagine how Retief and his men had to endure these festivities in silence, as a Sunday was a hallowed day to the Voortrekkers. But Retief did not want to antagonize Dingaan with the treaty safely in his satchel, so they had to appear to take an interest. Many historians blame Retief for ignoring the warnings of some of his own people, the British settlers in Port Natal and the missionary Owen. By choosing to believe in Dingaan's sincerity, Retief was also aware of the fact that the land granted to him by Dingaan had already been promised to the British settlers in Port Natal. But his ideal of a safe, independent Voortrekker Republic was as good as done, and he was in a hurry to return to his people. Retief wanted to depart on Monday, the 5th of February, but Dingaan announced that he wanted to bid them farewell on Tuesday the 6th. The Zulus started dancing again, and the trekkers were uneasy. As was the custom, They left their horses and rifles outside the capital. On Dingaan's order, kill the wizards. Retief and his men were overpowered and their hands tied with thongs. They were taken to a nearby hill, Kwa Matiwani, and killed with fighting sticks. Their 30 servants were also killed. What prompted Dingaan to carry out such a treacherous deed? Many reasons are given. It's a fact that Dingaan feared the trekkers, who were entering his land in large numbers. Their victory over Mzilikazi's Matabeles and the apparent ease with which they defeated Sikonyela strengthened his distrust in the trekkers. He would destroy the whites in his land once and for all. The murder of Retief and mobilization of Dingaan's forces the next day was witnessed by the missionary Owen. His house was situated on a hill outside the capital. Although Dingaan assured him of his safety, he packed his belongings and left for Port Natal to leave the country, never to return. The unsuspecting trekkers were in the areas now known as Escort, Colenso and Vienen when they were attacked on the night of Saturday, the 17th of February, 1838. Luckily, some of the loggers received news of the attacks and could temporarily halt the Zulu forces, but the damage had already been done. All their livestock was taken, and 282 fur trekkers and 250 servants were dead. A section of the Zulu force also attacked Port Natal and destroyed everything. The British settlers found shelter on a ship in the harbour, escaping certain death. After the death of Retief, Gerrit Maritz, Piet Uys and A.H. Potgieter were elected as the leaders of the voortrekkers in Natal. A commando under the leadership of Uys and Potgieter was drawn into an ambush at Italeni on the 6th of April, 1838. Piet Uys and his son died, and Potgieter and his men had to flee for their lives. This expedition would henceforth be known as the Vlugkommando in Afrikaans, meaning the commando that flees. The voortrekkers accused Potgieter of cowardice. He was so aggrieved about this that he took his people back over the Drakensberg and would later play an important role in the Transvaal and the South African Republic. The Zulus launched an attack on Gat's lager, also known as Vechlaar, meaning a lager ideal for fighting, next to the Busmans River in a deep valley on the 13th of August 1838. The valley afforded the trekkers natural defences, and this time they were prepared. A wagon lager, of which all the entrances were blocked with thorn branches, was the only way to repel an attack. The 75 prepared men were only able to drive off the Zulus on the third day. Dingaan was not impressed with the performance of his warriors at Gat's lager, and he demoted them to the left horn unit of young recruits. This was a big embarrassment to them, and they had to do something in order to gain back Dingaan's favour. Gerrit Maritz died on the 23rd of September 1838. With Potgieter leaving Natal and Uys dead, the trekkers were now without a leader. But a voortrekker deputation had already arrived in Graaf Reinet in the Eastern Cape in August of 1838, to ask a well-known and respected man to join the voortrekkers in Natal. That man was Andries Pretorius. He was elected as chief commandant of the voortrekkers and immediately began preparing a military commando for a possible attack by the Zulus. 5 days later, the commando, consisting of 57 wagons and 400 men, departed in a northeastern direction towards Umgungunglovu. They would now take the offensive to stop Dingaan's attacks. Along the way, some more able men joined the commando with their wagons. The idea of a covenant with God had its origin with Andries Pretorius. If God gave them victory over the enemy, they would build a church in his honor, and they and their descendants would commemorate the day of victory as a Sabbath. They made a lager on Sunday the 9th of December, 1838, at Vassbank. During the morning devotional service, Sorel Selier included the covenant as part of his prayer. The covenant was repeated every day until the 15th of December. Aside from the covenant, Pretorius laid down strict instructions to the men as to their code of conduct and common goals concerning the battle. The commando approached an area 30 kilometers southwest of Vryheid, from a hill in the west, later to be known as Vegkop, or Fighting Hill. They travelled down a slope to the Ntlhome River, moving in columns of four. Some of the wagons had already crossed the river when the scouts returned and reported seeing the main Zulu force at Umkutu, about 20 kilometres away. The Zulus would therefore reach the lager that evening. Pretorius immediately ordered the wagons to come back across the river. He also recalled all the scouts with a cannon shot. They moved slightly to the south and formed a lager where bronze wagons commemorating the event now stand. The trekkers were trained so well that the lager was formed within an hour. Pretorius departed with 300 men to confront the Zulus, but decided to cancel the operation as it was already afternoon and the next day would be Sunday. Tactically speaking, this was the correct decision. A confrontation with the Zulus in the open veld would, as experience had taught them, be risky. But let's take a closer look at the lager and the surrounding area. The lager consisted of 64 wagons, giving it a circumference of 400 meters, about the size of an athletics track around a football field, with a diameter of 65 meters. With 10 oxen per wagon, there were 640 oxen in the lager, fastened to posts in the ground with thongs. The oxen were exceptionally tame and used to the sound of gunfire and cannons. It's estimated that there were also about 750 horses. The manpower consisted of 464 trekkers, including three British settlers, accompanied by 100 Zulus, 100 wagon drivers, and about 120 coloured men. A total of about 800 men. Only the trekkers and the three British settlers would actively take part in the battle. The others would tend the livestock and help load the cannons and rifles. The gaps between the wagons were about 2 meters in size. They were closed with battle palisades constructed before their departure on Pretorius' request. He knew that there would not always be thorn branches available to fill the gaps. Battle palisades were also placed between the front and back wheels and then chained to the wagons. These palisades prevented the enemy from penetrating the lager. The artillery consisted of three cannons, one at the main entrance to the north, one at the northwestern side, and another to the east. The cannons were used sparingly because they consumed a lot of gunpowder that could be more effectively used in the muzzle-loading rifles loaded with slugs. The main entrance at the northern side was closed by pulling together two wagons with their wheel shafts pointing to the inside of the lager, so that the entrance could be easily opened and closed by moving the wagons forwards or backwards. The cannon known as chriki was mounted on an undercarriage of heavy iron wheels instead of the more usual wagon axle and positioned at the gate. When mounted on wagon wheels, the cannon had the disturbing habit of falling over backwards when fired. Chriki is on display at the Voortrekker Monument in Pretoria. Today it's mounted on wagon wheels to make it easier to move. The cannon on the northwestern side was named Weeskind, meaning orphan, because so many children, so it's said, were made orphans when the cannon was fired. Chriki and Weeskind. These cannon were loaded with shrapnel, pieces of pot iron, stones and nails, and could fire up to 300 or 400 meters, and were devastating at shorter distances. The cannon to the east belonged to Pretorius. It was a 3-pounder. In other words, it could only fire a round bullet of 3 pounds, about 1.5 kilograms. Depending on the charge of gunpowder, it could fire up to 1,500 meters. Every man normally had 3 or more muzzle-loading rifles, and with assistance to load them, the shots followed each other rapidly. The trekkers stood between the wagons to shoot, about 8 men in every opening. On horseback, it was possible to fire 4 shots per minute, if the rifle fired every time. On the outside of the laager, lanterns were hung on the ends of whip handles fastened to the wagons. Although the flames were not very bright, they were enough for lookouts to spot a moving figure near the wagons. The glow also made it possible for the Voortrekkers to aim their rifles accurately. Was it coincidence that the commando arrived in an area where a deep ravine with its sides more than 4 meters high was situated at the southern end of the laager? Was it also a coincidence that they would have a river on their eastern side that originally ran deeper and wider, with a hippopotamus pool deeper than the length of a whip handle? These were natural barriers or traps. Could it, in the words of Sorrel Celia, be the Lord in his ultimate providence, who coincidentally led them to this spot? The laager was not very close to the river on the eastern side because it had rained and the area was marshy. Originally, the area was overgrown with reeds. Towards the south, the laager was also not too close to the ravine, but about 40 meters away, so that it would be out of the reach of the throwing spears if the Zulus decided to attack from that side. That evening, the trekkers had a devotional service under the leadership of Sorrel Celia. The covenant was repeated for the last time, and the Voortrekkers prayed together and sang Psalm 38. Pray, forsake me not forever. Be thou never far removed from me, O God. Hasten, Lord of my salvation, in compassion, to uphold me with thy rod. The Zulus must have been near, because they could hear the Voortrekkers singing, but it was interpreted as wailing. The Zulus in turn sang their own warrior song. We journey to war, over the hills yonder, over the hills where the sun sets, to a country we do not know. We journey for you, King and Father, Lion, Elephant, Liberator, King of Kings, King of the Zulu, Dingaan, we greet you. Then everything became quiet. It is unlikely that anyone fell asleep. 800 men awaited the arrival of the Zulus and the possibility of a night attack. The Zulu force, under Mkhlela, commander-in-chief, approached the lager just after midnight. In other words, on the 16th of December, 1838, from a southeasterly direction. The two horns of the attacking force arrived first, with the left horn, consisting of the demoted and humiliated warriors, nearest to the Ntsome River. A heavy fog rolled over the lager, and the only thing the Zulus could see was the dim flickering of the lanterns on the whip handles. They thought it was the Voortrekker ancestors protecting the lager, and, contrary to their normal procedure, they did not attack during the night. This was a costly tactical error. Had the Zulu attacked the lager during the night, the Voortrekkers would easily have been overpowered. Their muzzle-loading rifles would not fire in the wet, foggy weather. The left horn, the section nearest to the river, decided to attack the lager on their own and thereby win back Dingaan's favor. They forded the river at a drift, about 600 meters south of the lager, and went slightly to the west to avoid the ravine, thereby ending up in an area just to the west of the lager. But then they lost their way in the heavy fog. It appeared as if the lager had totally disappeared. Strangely, or even mysteriously enough, the horses and oxen in the lager didn't make a sound. Any sound would have given away the position of the lager to the Zulus. In the lager, the trekkers could hear the shuffle of 4,000 pairs of feet outside in the dark. It sounded like thundering water coming down on them, or strong wind blowing. It was overwhelming, terrifying. They could even smell the Zulus' bodies smeared with fat. In desperation, the lost left horn then formed a semicircular position, 100 meters deep, 50 meters from the lager, and settled down. The scene was set for the most famous, most unique, and most epic battle in the history of South Africa. At sunrise the following morning, the fog lifted within minutes. It was a bright, sunny day, an ideal day for the rifles and cannons of the trekkers. The trekkers must have been horrified to see 4,000 Zulus within 50 meters of the lager. Perhaps equally horrified were the Zulus as the lager arose from the mist in front of them. When the Zulus received the order, they first started with their attack drill by hitting on their shields, jumping up and down, whistling and shouting their battle cry, "Usutu!" Before the Zulus could gather momentum and throw their spears, the trekkers fired their rifles and Weerskind, the cannon on the western side, and created havoc. Wave upon wave of Zulus attacked, but their utterly closed ranks and their dead friends were a great hindrance. The throwing spears fell short of the lager. They could not bear the terrible assault of the Voortrekkers much longer, and some of them tried to hide in the ravine towards the southern end of the lager. The trekkers moved out of the lager at the southern end and fired down the bank into the churning mass of bodies in the ravine. This was too much for the Zulus. Those in the ravine began fleeing towards the south through the ford. The trekkers pursued them on horseback and killed hundreds more. More than 1,000 Zulus died. This then was the first phase of the battle that took place from 6:30 to 8 o'clock in the morning. The trekkers scarcely had time to rejoice over their apparent success and to prepare their weapons and ammunition when the rest of the Zulu force approached from the southeast and took up positions in front of Shogane Heights. 16 Zulu commanders gathered slightly further to the north. When the right horn saw their brothers of the left horn flee, they stormed the river. However, they could not cross it, and the trekkers fired on them from the opposite bank. While the battle was raging at the river, Pretorius ordered that his cannon on the eastern side of the laager be directed to the hill where the commanders were gathered. It was nearly 2,000 meters away. Rocks were placed under the cannon to give it elevation, a double load of gunpowder was used, and the shot was fired. 12 of the 16 commanders were killed. Was it just a lucky shot? It's alleged that the death of the commanders totally unsettled and demoralized the Zulu force. It was also the only shot fired by the cannon during the battle, and it fell over backwards. The right horn could not succeed in crossing the river directly across from the laager, so they swerved southwards towards the drift below the ravine. The head and chest, which were congregated on the slopes of the Shogane, followed them. They moved through the drift, around the ravine, and approached the laager from the west. Some time passed between the battle at the river and the last movement of the Zulus. This was the end of phase two of the battle. The number of Zulus killed from the right horn at the river is not known. The third phase would be the main attack. The force descending on the laager now consisted of about 12,000 men. The right horn attacked immediately and launched one attack after another at the laager with their throwing spears. However, just like the left horn, they were repelled with rifle and cannon fire from the fur trekkers. There was great confusion. When an attack failed, the older regiments, the head and chest, swore at their comrades and constantly tried to pass their ranks. The fur trekkers wanted to prevent the Zulus from resting or sitting down to wait for the dark. Their ammunition was getting low. At 11 o'clock, the Zulu attacks ceased. They started to withdraw, and Pretorius rode out with 150 men to divide them into two groups. The Zulus, who fled towards the east, tried to cross the river, but they were shot in the water by the fur trekkers. The blood of about 1,000 Zulus turned the water of the Ntome River red. Afterwards, it was known as Blood River. The pursuit continued through the river in a northerly direction towards Shogane and Ntabana. Miraculously, there were only three trekker casualties, the most serious of which was Andries Pretorius, who was wounded in the hand by a spear. The group swerving towards the left moved in a southerly direction around the ravine to the drift, and then in a northern direction. This area would later be known as Mtambo, the Plain of Bones. Other Zulus fled west towards Fachkop. The trekkers pursued them for 3 hours. Towards the late afternoon, everyone returned to the laager. The Battle of Blood River was over. Pretorius' commando would henceforth be known as the Ven Commando, or Winning Commando. But the scene outside the laager was one of the most tragic sights in the history of Africa. The battlefield was strewn with corpses. More than 3,000 Zulus died. Why was it destined to happen? Perhaps only the words of the South African poet C.M. van den Heerfer convey the cold reality which was hidden by the slowly setting sun that 16th of December 1838. He saw the tragedy of a courageous young Zulu warrior reaped in one moment. Your body gleams like copper on the felt. The bending grasses drop on you, their morning dew. Here where you sleep, your final sleep. Your snow-white plumes still quiver, as if in war, but the dark stain beside you is blood lost in the sand. Your hand, lifeless and grey beside the bright keen spear. Your king, Inumgungunglovu, will wait for you, his hands shading his eyes, lost far amidst the blue where you went out to war. And he will wait for the stamp of feet, the clatter of your advance, for the whirl of white betufted legs, untamed in battle dance. The hills will call you, and a Zulu girl alone, beside her fire, will watch at night, gazing in silence till the morning light. A religious service of gratitude was held in the lager, the first covenant service. The next morning, 17th of December 1838, the lager was dismantled and the trekkers started moving in a southwesterly direction towards Umgungunglovu, Dingaan's headquarters. They approached Umgungunglovu on the 20th of December 1838, but Dingaan had torched his capital and fled north with his followers. He was defeated, but not the Zulu nation. Andries Pretorius and the Voortrekkers made a gruesome discovery on the 22nd of December on Kwa Matiwane, where this monument was erected in 1922. The remains of Piet Retief and his men. They recognized Retief's skeleton from bits of clothing, his water bottle and satchel. The satchel still contained the transport document that Dingaan signed, completely safe. Three days later, it was Christmas, but it would be a gloomy day for the Voortrekkers. They buried the remains of Retief and his men at the foot of a hill on that day. The grave was restored in 1920, and a headstone was erected. The following year, 1839, the Voortrekkers declared the Republic of Natalia in the area that Dingaan granted to them. The area north of the Tugela was still considered to be Zulu land. For the interim, the yearning for freedom and independence had been satisfied, and they could focus their attention on carrying out the covenant. The first part of the covenant, that we would erect a house in his honour, was already completed in 1840, when the Voortrekkers utilised the Church of the Covenant that was built in Pietermaritzburg, their capital, for the first time. The Church of the Covenant can still be seen today. The gables and the foyer were added at a later stage. During the years following the Battle of Blood River, the 16th of December had been commemorated amongst many communities as a Sabbath. It was known as Dingaan's Day from 1910, but because of objections against the name, it was changed to the Day of the Covenant in 1952. After the elections in 1994, the new South African government reviewed the public holidays to reflect the diversity of peoples of the country. It was decided that the 16th of December would, in future, be known as Reconciliation Day. In many Afrikaner communities, the 16th of December is still commemorated in the spirit of the original covenant, as it was affirmed from the 9th to the 15th of December, 1838, and is reaffirmed at places such as the Blood River Heritage Site and the Voortrekker Monument in Pretoria. This program is based on information as it was recorded in archival and primary sources.
Now that you've watched the video, let's take a look at a few things as we analyze what happened and also see what of this is applicable to the rest of us today. This little map shows whites over a period of about 100 years. As they moved into South Africa, they came in via Cape Town, they came by ship, and then they started spreading through Southern Africa. And this eventually led to the Boers leaving the British colony and so forth. but this is the basic method by which whites came in and slowly started expanding into Africa and then running into conflict with the blacks. On this map, you can see the Great Trek again, and you can see the different treks and the directions they took, one of which led to the Battle of Blood River and the creation of one of the first Boer republics, which was the Republic of Natalia on the Natal coast. And the Boers had that republic for a couple of years before the British came, stole it, chased them out. The Boers and the British themselves had a battle over Natalia, and then the Boers moved more inland and they created two republics, one of them the Free State with the capital of Bloemfontein and the other one north of it the Transvaal. So this is how the whites migrated, and they were looking for empty spaces where they could live. And in this video we're not discussing the fact that the Zulus killed lots of blacks on the interior of South Africa and actually depopulated it, which the Boers later took advantage of. So this is the map of the Battle of Blood River as you saw it in the documentary, and you are familiar with the basic theme that of the fighting. But what I want to do is I want to discuss errors. Whites are always looking at their own errors. Whites are always talking about, oh, we made this mistake, we made that mistake. I've never yet heard whites talk about the mistakes of the blacks. For example, with the Zulus, what were their mistakes? Did they do everything perfectly? Well, they didn't. As you can see from that video, the Zulus actually could have attacked at night, and it was their intention to attack at night. And some of them were coming up close, but thanks to the fog, the mist, they actually couldn't really see where the Boers were. And it also says that there was superstition that those lanterns that the Boers had made the blacks think that these are the spirits of the whites. Some of this stuff is the first time I've heard of it. I've never heard of the night attack. I've never heard of the lanterns scaring the blacks and the blacks thinking that these might be spirits. The bottom line is that the blacks had their opportunity to attack at night, and they didn't. And it's their error. It's got nothing to do with the whites. Maybe there was some element of luck involved. Maybe some people will ascribe it to God or whatever. Or it's just plain luck. But mostly in warfare, there are a lot of things that are just pure luck. And sometimes luck is on your side, sometimes it's not. But if you don't try, you won't know. That's the other side of it. A big military mistake the blacks made was that group from, I think, the Left Horn, the group who went and attacked by themselves. They wanted to now prove that they were better than the others, and they attacked by themselves. They outnumbered the Boers literally 10 to 1, and still they couldn't defeat them. But in strict military terms, that was a mistake, because the Zulus had 16,000 troops. If you look at the numbers they put together, 4,000 in this attack and 12,000 in the other attack. So if they had attacked with all 16,000, which is what you do in a big battle, you would attack with everything, then things would have gone better. But in this case, they made idiots of themselves. They went and attacked, and the Boers shot them up, chased them away, killed them, and it probably gave the Boers some confidence, gave them a good feel for the fighting, so that when the main attack came, they already had their confidence up, etc. So the blacks made plenty of mistakes. plenty. Now let's take a look at the white man and his technology. Nobody ever discusses this. Nobody ever talks about the white man and his technology in ancient times, and even in more recent times like this. But you will find that the white male, right throughout history, whether you go back thousands of years ago or further, the white man always has his technology with him. And let's look at his technology. To give you a simple example, if you go and look at the Vikings, for example, the Vikings who spread out from Scandinavia, who went crazy in conquest and moving in all sorts of places, everything that the Vikings did was dependent on that special kind of ship that they invented. They invented a ship that had a special low draft that could sail even up shallow rivers. This design was critical for the Vikings to be able to achieve what they achieved. Without that technology, the Vikings would have still been sitting in Scandinavia. They wouldn't have been able to do much. But that design was so excellent, it allowed them to travel even across the Atlantic and to travel to all sorts of places and attack others simply because they had designed a vessel that could work for them. And the design was so successful and they built so many of them that it allowed them and gave them power and mobility to go everywhere else. As a side note, we never talk about the whites and the sea. White people and the ocean is a huge topic. And whites even coming to Africa, going to Australia, to Canada, to North America, is all due to our mastery of the sea. The sea is so important. The sea, in certain respects, is even more important than the land. No whites would even have been in Africa if it wasn't for the sailing ship. I like to think of the sailing ships as free energy. Whites were tapping into free energy hundreds of years ago. Those slow sailing ships that plodded along at 3 miles an hour through the seas, 24 hours a day, these slow plodding ships allowed whites to go all across the world, all around the world. It allowed us to move across huge oceans to go and even fight people sitting on the other side of the world. Nobody talks about this. And where are the other races and their technology? They didn't have any of these things. This technology allowed whites to leave Europe and to go and to conquer much of the entire earth. Go back and look at the ancient Greeks, long before the Vikings. What did they have? They had special kinds of armor, weapons, pikes. Their technology lay in the physical materials that they used and the design of their weapons and their armor. Again, the white man's technology. The Romans are the same. As you go through history, you'll see technology, technology, technology. You'll see bows and arrows, chariots. The Romans using fortifications, engineering, all kinds of methods of propelling arrows, of propelling rocks. All of these things is technology, technology, technology. Whites have used technology all the time in all their warfare, in all their struggles to exist. It's just technology, technology, technology. Go and look at the blacks that they were fighting. What technology did they have? The blacks had some technology, but their technology was already thousands of years too late. Whites had already been doing the same things as the blacks and in a more sophisticated way thousands of years ago. You cannot even equate the Zulus with the ancient Greeks. You can't do that because the ancient Greeks who lived more than 2,000 years ago, the ancient Greeks were more advanced than the Zulus of just 200 years ago. Whites do not look at their technology and the critical role of technology in every aspect of white life. It goes not just for movement or warfare or fighting or defense. The technology even moves into foods, medicines, surgical techniques. The Romans could perform operations. They had all kinds of military medicine with them 2,000 years ago, man. So all of these things that whites just ignore, take for granted, don't even think about, these things are playing a role and have played a role for thousands of years. And we don't even think about it. We don't even think about what our technology and the proper use of our technology allows us to do in the real world. So let's look at the Boers. What was the method by which the Boers traveled the most? It was on horseback. So their horses were like motorbikes. If you go and equate what the Boers were doing to what we have now, their horses were the same as having a cross-country motorbike, and off you go. They traveled long distances with those horses. Those horses gave them speed, gave them mobility. The wagons which carried all their possessions and all their supplies, that was like their trucks. The Zulus didn't have that. The Zulus didn't even have the wheel. The muskets that the Boers had, those muskets are the same as buying a military rifle. Today it looks a bit outdated, but in its day, that was the top military weapon of its time. And those Boers could not have gone and faced those blacks. They could have gone with spears to go and face the blacks if they'd wanted to, but the truth of the matter is they were using muskets because it was a better weapon. More advanced weapon allows them to do other things. It's a technical tool. And all of these things are tools. The white man and his tools. And we must not forget how important these tools are right throughout history in everything we do. Right now on the internet, in the age of the internet, we're sitting with a tool called the internet and we don't even think about it. Yet everything is a tool and you're only as good as the tool that you use. There at the battle they had three little cannons. And as you heard, the little cannons needed to be put down on smaller wheels because those little cannons were not that good and that they could fall over backwards. But they knew their technology and that was like having artillery. By the way, all these things that they had were things they had to procure themselves. They had to buy and acquire all these weapons themselves. The British didn't give it to them. The British weren't interested in it. They had to acquire all these tools themselves at their own cost, and they had to go out with these tools to go and face their enemies, to go and see what they could seek. So they had those little cannons were used to great effect. It gave them artillery, something the Zulus didn't have. By the way, I'm not totally sure about the story about the 12 Zulu leaders being killed by the artillery. If so, it sounds very awesome. But there is a little bit of something about that that makes me wonder how accurate that is. I find it hard to believe that in one shot that they could have killed 12 of the leaders at that distance. I also wonder whether in producing this documentary, whether there are some things where blacks have been coming and making excuses. I don't know. So that's the first time I've heard of that. If it's true, excellent firing there on the part of the whites. But there is something that sounds a little bit dodgy about that story. Maybe they had an effect, but I find it hard to believe that they could kill 12 out of 16 with a single shot at 2 kilometers. That I'm finding a bit hard to believe. But anyway, be that as it may, the wagons were also turned into mobile forts. Did you see the panels that they put between them so that even if they didn't have thorn brush, that they could actually create like a wall? And the Boers had used thorn bushes between and under the wagons in the past in order to create a kind of a wall. So those wagons are a mobile fort. And it worked very well for them. And the name for those wagons when they're drawn together like that is called a lager. And I'm quite sure that the whites in America also did similar things. But these mobile forts were extremely, extremely useful. It allows them to stand and shoot at the enemy without the enemy quite getting up close to them. And they can shoot at them long before the enemy can even throw arrows at them. Another aspect of this little army, which is also actually quite common in white history, is that this was actually a multiracial group. You had a whole bunch of black servants who were looking after the animals, etc. None of them were armed. The whites obviously did not trust them, and they did not trust any of their non-white assistants with weapons. And that's very important. These things have happened before. These things have happened before in history where you've got people and they've got like their slaves or their servants who come with them, and here they had them. And they even had 100 Zulus who were with them. Also, not as fighters, but they were there and they assisted them in whatever way. So what you've got is you've got a multiracial army, but the people in charge and running everything are the whites. The whites are the leaders of the multiracial group, and in this case, the whites are also the fighters in this grouping. This is not that different to the Roman army. The Roman army did a lot of these sorts of things. The Roman army did many things like this, where they had other troops with them. These troops were known as auxiliaries. And these auxiliaries would be from other nations and even other races. And the auxiliaries would, in the case of the Romans, the auxiliaries were troops, but they were troops with less firepower and more specialized. Like often the Romans used cavalry, because their own cavalry wasn't that good, and the Romans would be the heavy infantry. But if you equate this with the Boers were in this case the heavy infantry. And then they've just got non-whites helping to do various labor, and they can trust their non-whites. Their non-whites aren't turning against them. That is important. So you are seeing a multiracial thing where whites are the leaders. And right throughout the history of Africa, until black rule came, whites always operated like this. We would drive things, we would control things, we would be the leaders, and we'd tell the blacks what to do. And this system worked. As long as they listened to us, and as long as we had the ability to discipline them and control them, this did work. And it worked amazingly well. But the key thing is that the whites must be in charge. They must control everything. And it works very well. And here are the Boers looking for a place to create a Boer country, but they're taking servants with them. Whites in Europe also had servants and slaves. A third of the population of the Roman Empire were slaves. The Spartans had more slaves than their own people. So having other races do some of your work for you is something whites have done before, and it has worked. It has worked. So it's just the way that this setup worked here. But the key thing is white leadership. Whites totally in control. The non-whites are only servants and they only carry out the tasks that the whites determine that they can do. And I want to repeat to you, this system does work. If you want to do multiracial stuff that does work, this is the only way to do it. If you have black leaders, if you have the whites and blacks as equals, none of this stuff works. None of it works. This can even be shown to be so even in modern times, even in the war in Angola in the 1980s. Even the Russians had to use this system. Although they didn't publicize it, the Russians controlled an army that was multiracial. It was a Russian general in charge. Russians controlled everybody and put everybody in their place and made sure that it functioned in a certain way. When whites dominate a multiracial organization, whites are very effective and the entire thing is very effective. And this has been proven throughout history. But that does not mean that you make them equal. You cannot make them equal. The moment you make them equal, you start losing out again. It then falls apart. And worse still is when you make them the leaders. That is total rubbish. That doesn't work at all. But this particular method of organization has worked for all kinds of different whites all over the show, all across Africa. In World War I, there was a German army in what is now Tanzania, German East Africa. It was commanded by German officers and had black soldiers, and it fought very well, and it did very well. That's not to say that the blacks are as good as the whites as soldiers. They can still be poorer than the whites as soldiers, even then. But this method of organization is not bad. This is the only way in which you can work with multiracial groups. And it also shows you that whites can be busy doing something of their own, and the non-whites would go along with it, mainly because they are getting economic benefits. That why are those non-whites with the whites? They're there because the life that they are getting, the pay that they are getting, all of that is better than if they lived in their own villages. That's why they are living like that. That is why they go with them. That is why they are their servants. Because if they had to go back to their huts and live in their huts, they would starve to death. They'd have all kinds of problems. So it's economic. Economic is the real reason these non-whites are sticking with these whites. And that is really the bottom line there. There was also a proper organization in this group, and they had appointed a single leader, this Pretorius guy, and he made the rules. So in military stuff, you always have only one leader. It's a topic I'll get back to, but the organization of the structure was completely accurate. And I'm going to leave it at that. One could say many more things. I think the only other thing that I want to add is, why did Dingaan attack the whites? My own view of it all along, and I see it's reflected in here as well, my own view of it is that Dingaan saw that the whites are coming and the whites are growing larger in number. And what you don't know is that further south in the Eastern Cape, the whites had lived there for a long time and they had fought against the Khoza tribe for a very long time. So the Zulus would know what had happened to the Khoisas. They would obviously have contact with them. They would hear the news over time. The Zulus know that the Khoisas had fought long wars against the whites in the Eastern Cape, and the whites had defeated them. And these whites are moving in. They're moving closer and closer. And now these whites are wanting to live across the river. They're asking for territory. It could even be, they didn't raise this in the documentary, but it could even be that Dingaan thought that by giving these whites this request to go and get the cattle, that he thought that this would put the whites off. that he gave them this hurdle to overcome. He said to them, go get those cattle from those guys who stole it from me. And he thought, well, that should be enough to put the whites off, and the whites will bugger off. But these whites were determined enough to go and get the cattle, and they successfully got the cattle, and they brought them back. So it could be that in and of itself was his attempt to gently indicate to the whites in a gentle way, give them a task that he's sure they won't be able to complete. And then they do complete it, to his horror, and they come back and they now want the land. And this can also add to the fact that he realizes, you know what, these guys are determined. These people are capable of doing this. These people could be a danger and a threat. And the fact that they carried out the task could very easily indicate to him that these people are a bigger threat than he thought they were. These are determined people, they're tough people, and they're going to do this stuff. And they could do it against him. So his murder of the whites is actually, to me, not that surprising. I think that Dingaan looked at this and he saw, oh man, we got trouble coming here. These whites have already beaten the Khoisas in the Eastern Cape. These whites are going to come here. They're going to start growing in population. They're going to settle down. They're going to be right on my border. And look at them. They're already moving in, because there were whites in various groups already. And these different groups were there. And he could see, man, these whites are going to settle and we're going to have lots of war with these people. And these people have got all kinds of magic. These people are dangerous. They've got their strange weapons that can kill at a distance. These people are dangerous. We cannot have them as our friends. And so him bringing these whites in, and notice when the whites go into the camp, they have to leave their weapons outside. That's the requirement. So when he orders them to all be killed, notice that he also orders them to go and attack all the other whites who've already started settling in the various groups. And they kill a whole bunch of Boers. And then you've got that group of 75 who are by the river who survive. And they survive in their laager. So you can see how the tactics of the Boers are getting better, as some of them are killed in the night and they're not good at defending, but others are able to survive and their methods are already starting to work. So by the time the big group comes with Pretorius as the leader, after all these attacks, the whites already have learned a lot from their expeditions and their exercises, and they're no longer going to be just caught off guard like this. So I think that among the Afrikaans people, among the Boers, they tend to look on Dingaan's actions as being highly treacherous. I don't think that's a correct interpretation. That's maybe a Christian way of looking at it. Oh, we went and we signed the papers and this and that, and they behaved like animals, etc. No. To me, when I look at this thing, it's very clear. The blacks saw this as a threat. They had prior history. They had knowledge. They could see clearly the white man is a danger. The white man can pose a threat to them. And more are coming. Notice that they not only attacked the Boers in their wagons, they also went to Port Natal and wiped out the English there. And the English had to rush onto the ships. It shows you, man. He knew what he was doing. He'd thought this thing through. He knew he had to chase these people away, get these people out, chase them as far away. It's a preemptive strike. Kill their leaders so that their leaders aren't there anymore. Wipe them out, chase them away, get rid of them. The problem is, these Boers are tough. And these Boers come back. And they form a new column and they come back. What is not mentioned in this documentary is that the Boers later on teamed up with another guy in the Zulu ranks. They teamed up with this guy. They actually then played the role of kingmaker. And in the role of kingmaker, they basically said to this other Zulu chief or wannabe chief, you know, we can make you the king of the Zulus. And, you know, we'll help you. You gather your army, we'll come with our army, and we'll take on Dingaan. And also, you will have noticed that when the Boers came back after Blood River, that Dingaan burned down his capital and he retreated to the north. Again, clear proof, he was scared to death of these whites. Then these Boers teamed up with, I think it's his half-brother or whatever it is, I can't remember the name, but they teamed up with that guy, they struck a deal, they said, look, we'll work with you, and let's go and attack Dingaan, and you destroy him, and you rule the Zulus. And in the other old Battle of Blood River story that I did a couple of years ago, I talked about how this happened. And the Zulus, who were under this, let's call it this treasonous chief, they were so delighted to have the Boers on their side that they actually raced ahead of the Boers and attacked the other Zulus and even defeated them in battle, while the Boers were just casually coming along behind. And the Boers were spending most of their time stealing cattle. I think they stole something like 40,000 cattle. And so their guy that they were sponsoring, he beat Dingaan. He became the chief of the Zulus. So the Boers had not only invaded Zulu territory, they had screwed with Zulu politics. They had turned the one Zulu against the other, that created a civil war, that also stole 40,000 cattle for themselves. It was freaking win-win. They had totally fucked with their enemy's political structure, destroyed that king, and we can say that Dingaan correctly saw them as a threat, tried to protect his people, and in the end, the Boers actually turned his own politics against him and smashed them. And there you have it. You know, there's more to Blood River than just the battle. The consequences of this is just fantastic. It was just win-win all the way. But what pissed the Boers off was the so-called treachery and the killing of Retief. And the truth of the matter is, once they got angry and they decided to go and fight back, look at all the things that happened that they managed to pull off. And they even had their little republic for a time until the British came and stole it from them. Then most of them moved out of Natal into the Transvaal and the Free State, and they went and beefed up those republics there, and those eventually became their real republics that they settled in. But the Battle of Blood River is more than just Blood River, but it shows you what came from their adventurous spirit and from preparing and learning and facing things with courage. They like to attribute all their victories to God, etc. I don't think so. I think that they just did logical, good stuff, like whites normally do, and it worked for them. And in the future, the lesson for us for the future is that in anything that we do in the future, we should take technology absolutely seriously. And the right thing is, take the technology, put it in your hands, don't put it in the hands of others. You can have non-white allies, but make sure you don't give them your best stuff. Be careful how you handle them. You can have non-white allies coming and helping you to fight against their own people. It actually works. And I want to tell you, it could work in Africa in the future. The notion that these things cannot happen again, it's total nonsense. These things can happen again. But you just need to get your head cleared, and you must realize the importance of technology, discipline, tactics, logical thinking, and some courage and an adventurous spirit. Honestly, that is the lesson. And whites all over the world have had a spirit of exploration, settling, etc. Whites go and they find places for themselves, they settle down. The whites of Europe, maybe because they've lived in Europe for so long, maybe they don't realize the adventurous, colonizing, warrior, exploring spirit of our race. They don't realize that. Maybe the Germans were the last to realize it. But we do have that kind of spirit, and it's fun, and it's exciting, and it's natural. And we've been doing this for tens of thousands of years. And we mustn't think that this is the end. But just look back on our history and the role of our technology, our weapons, and our tools. Get to know your tools, all of the tools of modern life. Get to know them, get to use them. Start thinking how you can use them. And don't be that afraid. Get out there and face the enemies. You're going to be surprised by what's going to come from this. So, I hope that you've learned something from the Battle of Blood River. And I hope it'll make you realize that the future is far from conclusive. Death for whites is not a proven fact. There's plenty to do, but you've got to adapt and update your thinking. So that's it for today. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.